This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. It's July. Back in April, we did a show about birds. We kept the focus on common birds we could see from our own backyards. But a backyard with bird feeders and maybe a few trees is a specific kind of habitat. It's not a wetland. It's not a prairie. It's not a forest. Today, we're going to talk about some of the other birds you can see in Indiana if you venture out. If you have questions or comments about birding in Indiana today, whether it's sharing what you've seen and where, or asking for advice on what to do or where to go, we're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Leave a quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it in front of our panel and into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me on Skype are three guests. Cliff Chapman is Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. Welcome back, Cliff.
Hey, thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
Rob Ripma is here. He's president of the Amos Butler Audubon Society. Hi, Rob.
Hi, happy to be here.
Wes Hamoya is a professional bird guide and the founder of Feathers and Fermentation Tours. Hi, Wes.
Hey, Matt. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's get some quick introductions out of the way. Cliff, what is the Central Indiana Land Trust?
So thanks, Matt. The Central Indiana Land Trust is a private, not-for-profit nature preservation organization. We work in the central third of the state of Indiana, and we basically protect natural areas and protect them in perpetuity.
And Rob, can you tell us about the Amos Butler Audubon Society?
Yeah, Amos Butler Audubon Society is a chapter of the National Audubon Society that serves Marion and the surrounding counties.
And how is that different from the Indiana Audubon Society, whom we had on last time?
So Indiana Audubon Society is a statewide organization in Indiana, but they are not affiliated with National Audubon. We are the local chapter. You'll find local chapters throughout the state, and we're just happen to be the one in central Indiana.
All right, Wes, how long have you been leading bird tours?
Several years, basically, ever since I started, ever since I graduated from Purdue University in 2013.
And so, but it was something that you had been doing for a long time before then, right? I mean, not leading bird tours, but birding itself.
Yes, absolutely. Ever since I was about 6 years old and found my dad's National Geographic field guide, I started to memorize it. Some folks may know my father, Michael, from previous shows with you.
Yeah, indeed. We've had Mike on a couple of times, and he's a birder as well, as I understand. How far have you gone to lead a birding trip, Wes? Where have you been?
Well, about as far as you can go. I've led tours in Australia, other places in Asia, and South America as well.
Where do you, I guess, when it comes to like leaving the country and getting way out to do it, where would you say you frequent, or do you frequent anywhere?
Well, I've tried to mix it up over the years. I like to see as many places as possible, but probably Ecuador would be the area that I know the best.
And why is that?
Well, I lived there and helped run an eco lodge called Tandiapa Bird Lodge for several months, and then got to basically base myself there and lead tours all around the country from there. And it's such an amazing and diverse region.
And will we see some of the birds that pass through Ecuador and Indiana at times from migration?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yes, there are quite a few birds that we call neotropical migrants, New World migrants that come from, they'll winter in Central South America, Caribbean, and then they'll come here in the summer and breed here. They'll make it their summer home. So it's really neat to see birds down there that that you've only known from up here normally.
So while we're talking about Indiana birds, the birds that you can see in Ecuador could be at certain times of the year very much the same, it sounds like. Cliff, among the preserves owned and managed by the Central Indiana Land Trust, what kinds of habitats are represented?
Well, really, the three main habitats that you described at the beginning of the show, most of the preserves that we own and manage are forested, you know, have different types of woodland habitats, whether oak hickory or beech maple. But then also we have some wetland areas that support a completely different group of birds that actually Wes has led a bird tour at in Boone County, Indiana. There's a marsh that we own. And then we also have some prairie habitat that supports birds you might call grassland birds. And then really the other habitat that we don't necessarily have represented in our preserve system, and most conservation organizations don't, but it's a pretty common habitat type throughout the state once you get out of your backyard or your neighborhood, are just kind of fields, open fields. And there's some birds that like to just kind of hang out maybe in the wintertime in our cornfields.
So, Wes, when it comes to common habitats in Indiana that people may live near, I suppose, what would be a good one to start with if someone is interested in just getting started in birding? And should they go by themselves? Should they go with someone who knows what they're doing? What would you say, I guess, to start with some basics?
Well, it sort of depends on your interest and level of intensity you want to go. You can certainly go out on your own, and there's nothing better than going out and finding a new species that you haven't seen before and identifying it on your own. That's quite a thrill. But certainly your speed at which you'll be able to get better at identifying birds and knowing where to find them will increase if you do hook up with your local Audubon group or find some local birder friends. A lot of times you can join Facebook groups and find some that way as well. But yeah, you can do it both ways. Either way is great and have their own pros and cons. And as far as habitats, we certainly have quite a bit of forest. In central Indiana, we don't have quite as much prairie or wetland, but you can find those spots too. My dad used to always say, in Indiana, we have, there's more than corn. We have fields of soybean too, but we do actually have a decent amount of forest, and there are some little pockets of prairies and wetlands too, for sure.
And Rob, I mean, that's kind of what we're talking about here, right? The birds that come to our backyards, I mean, they're used to people. They're numerous. They like our feeders, but that certainly cannot be said about all birds. Is it fair to say that what we see at home is probably completely different from what we'd see if we went to, say, a nature preserve?
You're definitely going to get a lot of different variety of nature preserve. You're probably going to see some of the birds that you have in your backyard. You know, you're still going to have cardinals and blue jays and chickadees around. But the nature preserves are going to give you a wider variety due to their habitat. And so it's a fun experience to get out there and see those new and different things that you're not getting in your backyard.
We got a message from Meredith on Facebook already, and I'm loving that we've gotten some Facebook messages already. Meredith says, I just took up birding during the pandemic and am loving it. There's a red-shouldered hawk that often hangs out near my house. It is beautiful, and I love watching it. But, man, it's loud, she says. Why does it call out all day, every day? Anyone want to help out Meredith?
Well, I can chime in. Basically, this is, you know, breeding season for our local birds, and those red-shouldered hawks more than likely have a nest nearby, and they are, you know, proclaiming their territory and sometimes communicating with each other. So it's both between species to let other species know not to mess with that spot, and also to tell each other, hey, you know, come over here, I'm hungry, or that sort of thing.
Is a big predator, Wes, like a red-shouldered hawk, I mean, is that an indicator of any kind of a certain kind of habitat or the health of a habitat or something like that?
Well, certainly for larger birds, they often will need, you know, they'll need smaller things to eat usually, and those, it works its way down you know, the food chain there. So yes, a large raptor, a large bird of prey is going to need at least a little bit of habitat. And in our area in Indiana, that means usually forested areas. So the big owls and the big raptors, they're going to need at least a decent block of woods. There can be, you know, some large fields adjacent, but along a creek or river or a large forest patch, they're probably going to need something of decent size, a few acres.
So, Rob, I'd like to get some basic birding tips going here, and we'll continue it in the next segment, of course, as well. But to get started, how does a typical birding session go? I mean, do you stay in one place and keep quiet? Do you try to cover a lot of ground? I'm a total noob here. What do?
So it's kind of somewhere in between that. You do cover some ground, but it's not quite like going out and hiking. So it's not like you're on a trail and just moving along quick. You're moving slowly and looking for different birds, listening for birds, which is an important part of finding what you're looking for. We a lot of times hear things way before we see them, especially in dense forested areas. And so it's kind of in between there on the hiking and just standing around waiting.
And Wes, how much depends on the time of year as far as what you will see?
Oh, big time. We're kind of coming up to what some birders call the slowest time of year, July. So,
really,
yes, and folks may want to be a little patient if they're going to try out birding right away. It's, you know, these long hot days. The birds don't want to be out in the heat any more than we do. So, best to get out right first thing in the morning. But also, depending on the time of year, you're going to see different things. So you've got, of course, spring and fall migration that folks are familiar with. The summer breeding season really peaks in early to mid-June. There's still going to be plenty of birds around, but they're, like I say, just maybe sometimes a little bit harder to find outside of the early morning and early evening. But yeah, they're out there.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about where to go and how to spot the birds you won't see in your backyard. If you have questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We look forward to hearing from you this hour. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about birding in Indiana, and we have with us Cliff Chapman, Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. Rob Ripma is President of the Amos Butler Audubon Society, and Wes Homoya is Founder of Feathers and Fermentation Tours. And we'd love your input on birding. If you have a birding story to share, or if you're curious about the hobby and you have questions, find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We have quite the crew here to help you out today. Wes Homoya, we're going to start with you in this segment. We're going to continue talking about some birding basics. So I'm sure everybody's different, but how do you like to handle a birding session? I mean, do you keep a log or anything like that? What do you bring with you?
I pretty much, and the more you get into birding, the harder it is to leave the house without your binoculars and camera. So, yes, I'll pretty much always have binoculars and camera on me or in the car. And my phone. Nowadays, it's nice with the smartphones. You have all these great apps for sounds and identification and keeping checklists and the apps that'll help you find where rare birds have been seen in your area and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of tools available to you nowadays that folks didn't have even 10, 20 years ago. But yes, those are the things I have. And just, again, depending on the time of year, will really determine what type of birding session I want to have. So, you know, the summer things are breeding, so there might be some breeding birds that I'm looking for at this time of year, or looking for a nest or that type of thing. Fall migration, spring migration, in the winter, there are things to look for as well. So it's different every time, and that's part of the fun of it.
And on the subject of gear, I mean, people can get really hung up on gear. You know, is when it comes to binoculars, does anything work there? Or, I mean, should you get good ones? Or does what you have already in your closet probably, is that going to cut it?
Well, you could try some of the older binoculars and some of the really cheap ones. I mean, you can get binoculars off of Amazon for like 15, 20 bucks. But I really encourage folks to skip those because it's just kind of throwing your money away, and you're going to be frustrated with how poor you're able to see anything. So if you can try to borrow some from friends or you know join up with a birding group, and somebody might have an extra pair if you're hesitant to invest right away. But they do make a lot of really good binoculars nowadays for introductory birders that are in that $100 to $200 range. So it's a little bit of a chunk of change, but certainly if you find that you're going to be using them regularly, I think it's well worth that investment.
Rob, what about expectations? The more time you spend, the more likely you are to see a lot of different species, I'm sure. But what should a beginner, I guess, expect out of a session?
You know, if you're going out on your own, I think what to expect is getting a lot of practice with finding the birds on your own and using your binoculars. That can be really tricky to start with. People tend to have a lot of trouble getting, even once they find a bird, getting binoculars on the bird. So I think as you start out and you're going out on your own, those are the things to focus on. If you're joining up with a group, like when Audubon Society offers bird hikes at different parks, you can expect to have someone helping you get onto those birds and to help you identify and tell what they are. And so both ways give you a really good opportunity to learn just in a little different way.
Now, if you are with a group, what about etiquette? Is there an etiquette that you should follow?
Yeah, you want to be quiet when you're out birding. Birds get a little scared if we have too much loud noise. So being quiet and respectful of that is super helpful. And then just following along with whatever the leader gives kind of as the instructions to start out.
Okay, so gear and prep are, well, okay, no, I've got a little more questions about, a little more to ask about gear. Rob, are there clothing choices that are a good idea, or are there other things perhaps gear-wise or prep-wise that beginners don't think about?
You know, clothing-wise, it's dictated by the fact that you're going to be outside and you're going to be in the elements, so you want to be comfortable with that. Temperature obviously plays a factor, but you also have to consider that summers in Indiana are buggy. So even though you think shorts might be the best option, it might be a very lightweight long pant will keep you a little more comfortable keeping those insects off of you. So that's really important. And then Wes had mentioned having your phone and having the apps on your phone. That's a little bit of pre-prep to do, but getting an app that will have a field guide on it and then help you identify birds would be important. There's a great app from Cornell University called Merlin from the Lab of Ornithology there at Cornell, and that's a great one to download, and it has a field guide in it as well as a way to help you identify birds asking a few short specific questions.
And that's as it turns out the one that I have, so it's good to have some validation from the experts. And thanks for that recommendation. Okay, so if gear and prep are out of the way, now we can decide on where to go. Cliff, what is a good habitat to visit that I guess most Hoosiers would have fairly available access to, where you might see some birds that you wouldn't necessarily find in a common backyard?
Well, I'll circle back to that in just a second, but I had one little gear thing to note as I was just out with some folks a few weeks ago in a forest. It was in a really nice forest, and we had a rare warbler that we were all trying to get eyes on and get binoculars on. And sometimes there's a misconception that bigger is better. And so having bigger, more powerful binoculars are going to help you find things easier when you're looking for a bird on a branch in a forest. And the person who was having a hard time finding it, and he said, "See, I knew I should have brought my scope." Talking about like a spotting scope, which would be much more powerful, much bigger. And that's the thing, is really you want to kind of draw it back a little bit to have a wider field of vision in the binoculars and then focus on something where the bigger, like something like a spotting scope in a forest would be sort of the wrong gear to bring looking for something that's moving a lot. It's better for looking for ducks on water or something that are not as mobile. But with that, to answer your question you asked me, I think the place to start, or the natural areas to start, would be a forested kind of habitat, either a nature preserve or even a park, or even by where we live, to just get away from the backyard, but still even be close to the neighborhood, hiking a trail or walking a walking path that has some habitat along it, and you can start getting warblers. And that's where, for like young children, we try to get our kids to see them, just the things like yellow warblers, which are pretty common, but not a backyard bird. It's going to be out more in a natural setting. And they have a cool song that's the kids like, because it kind of sounds like it's saying, "Sweet, sweet, I'm so sweet." And so the kids get a kick out of that. And so we try to bring the bird in, try to call the bird in a little bit, and so the kids can see a cool little bird like that.
Is this the song? Hold on just a second. That may have been it. All right. I have my Merlin bird app up, and I'm trying to see if I can play some of the songs. Okay, so there are a lot of birds that live in the forest there. You mentioned yellow warblers. What else could we expect to see in the forest this time of year that maybe a beginner might see on their first two or three sessions?
A bird that actually sings through the month of July, and they hardly ever stop singing, is red-eyed vireo. And red-eyed vireos can be found throughout the state. So whether you live closer to Louisville or Chicago, you can find red-eyed vireos in the forest. They just sing all day long, so it helps you find them. But other great forest birds that are pretty common and have a pretty good statewide distribution are things like Eastern Wood Peewee, which just has a really cool, it has a cool song. There's Acadian Flycatchers, which don't have such a cool song, but it's easy to remember because it's only two syllables. But then what really gets exciting, and what a lot of folks get kind of hooked on birds and birding, are warblers and our wood warblers. And honestly, Indiana, we are really blessed with having a really wide variety of really gorgeous warblers, like hooded warbler, Kentucky warbler, oven bird, Louisiana water thrush. I mean, you can just start listing a whole bunch of names that, if someone doesn't know what they look like or sound like, it could get boring. But just looking up a couple pictures of these things, like Kentucky warbler or scarlet tanager is another bird. That's a gateway bird that sometimes folks, they'll see their first scarlet tanager and just can't believe it's something that beautiful is in our woodlands. And they're really throughout the state of Indiana. They're pretty common.
Rob, we have a question from Chad on Twitter, who asks, what is the best way to attract orioles and bluebirds? And are bluebirds still a threatened species? Now, again, we're not necessarily talking about attracting birds today. We're talking about going out and birding. But let's help Chad out.
Yeah, absolutely. Baltimore Orioles are one of the birds that are super exciting to get in your backyard, and is one of the species that really starts to draw backyard birders out into birding outside of their yard. And to attract Baltimore Orioles, the best food for them is to do orange halves and then a little bit of grape jelly, as odd as that sounds. So that's the best thing for Baltimore Orioles.
Literally a half an orange covered with grape jelly?
Once the birds kind of eat some of the orange out, you can use the rind to put a little bit of grape jelly in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. And are bluebirds still a threatened species?
Bluebirds are not really a threatened species, but they're another one that's really exciting to get in your backyard. And the best thing to do for them typically is actually a bluebird house. You can feed mealworms, but that's not necessarily going to just draw them in. They're a little more habitat specific as well, so you got to be in the right spot.
We have a listener voicemail from Kathy with a question about identifying a bird. Let's listen.
I'm Kathy from Unionville, and I've had an earworm since May because of a bird which sings the first few bars of an aria by Humperdinck. It's Hansel's aria, and it starts out. That's what the bird sings, and I've had the earworm forever, so I want to know what bird it is. Thanks.
Sounds like a 60s song melody. Wes, does that ring a bell for you at all?
Well, I don't know about the exact tone sequence there, but I wonder about maybe our chickadee or perhaps titmouse. They have tones that are reminiscent of that. So that would be my guess, but see what Robert Cliff thinks.
Anybody else have something to help Kathy out? And Kathy, of course, could also get the Merlin Bird ID app and maybe peruse through, especially Kathy, if you heard that down in Unionville. I think doesn't the app let you know what birds are common in your area, like based on your geographic location?
It does, yes.
Okay, so maybe that might help you out, Kathy. Let's see. Rob, let's talk about a specific place that's a good spot for birding in Indiana, Goose Pond Fish and Wildlife Area near Linton. I understand there's a pretty significant story behind it. How did Goose Pond come to be?
Goose Pond is a really interesting spot for Indiana and a great conservation story for the state. It is about almost a little short of 10,000 acre marsh and prairie habitat.
Wow.
And it was... a group of organizations got together in order to purchase the property, including Nature Conservancy, Ducks Unlimited, and several others. And it was restored from pretty much farm fields into this incredible prairie and marsh habitat that it is today.
And is there evidence that at one time it was a natural marsh and then it was, like so many places in Indiana, drained to create a farm field? Is that what had happened there?
Yeah, like you said, so many places, but this one was fortunate to get restored.
So from a birding perspective, what makes Goose Pond so significant?
You know, it's a big enough chunk of habitat to give birds a huge area to come and either feed during migration, spend the winter, breed during the summer. So there's so much space that it gives the birds a lot of options there.
So when you go to Goose Pond, let's say you went right now in early July, what would you expect to see there?
In early July, you'd be looking for some of the breeding species that are down there. Things that are a lot more unusual in the state, things like there's a bird called blue grosbeak that should be nesting down there right now. We had a question earlier about Baltimore Oriole, a relative of the Baltimore Oriole called Orchard Oriole. Should be nesting in the habitat down there right now. There's an almost unending list right now of birds that you could get down in Goose Pond area.
Cliff, you're in the conservation business, so to speak, I guess. So how does birding relate to saving those places?
Well, there's a really good correlation, and we use kind of the techniques of birding to create these lists, sort of like what Wes was talking about, the tools of the trade when you go out. As we evaluate sites, we can think about what the expected bird species would be at a particular site and to judge habitat quality. And so there's a checklist that you could have where you just check off if you hear or see a species of bird that day. But what's really important is noting the number of individuals of each species. And so you might be able to go to three different woods and, you know, and three different days at the same time in the same week. And maybe one of them hear, say, five eastern wood peewees. And in an area the same size, you hear 10. And then in the next one, you might hear 15. And if they're the same size, same relative habitat, but one is supporting many more of the same species, and then that happens for many of these different species, if that makes sense, that site is showing you that it's more full of life, and so it has more of the resources needed for those different birds. And so you kind of put together the list of all the species and on all the numbers of individuals, and you can kind of come up with this term we use in ecology of fecundity, that is just really healthy and alive and vibrant. And so that would score higher or be a higher priority for protection.
And so birding is just an easy way to determine that that factor, the fecundity, I suppose.
It's one part, because we also will look at the plant species and various things and habitat disturbance. But the one thing that I like to tell people is birds don't read books, and so we as scientists go out and we're looking for certain elements because we've done research and we think we know what we're going to see or shouldn't see. But we need to listen to the land, and we need to listen to what the site is telling us. And birds are a really good way to be able to pretty quickly come up with an assessment along with these other elements.
There is a lot more to cover, including your questions and comments. We have a few to read off when we get back. Send yours in via Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or leave a voicemail at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881 as we talk about birding today. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about birding in Indiana, where to go and what to do. And we have three birders with us. Cliff Chapman is Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. Rob Ripma is President of the Amos Butler Audubon Society. And Wes Hamoya is founder of Feathers and Fermentation Tours. And we are live today, so we would love to hear your questions and comments for our panel. What do you want to share about birding? Or maybe you're just getting into it and you have questions. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. Or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. And we'll start this segment with one of those voicemails. This one's from Don with a question about Baltimore Orioles, a hot topic today. Let's listen.
This is Don in Syracuse, and we had at least two families of Baltimore Orioles this spring, and we fed them with jars of grape jam. And I think there was at least two or three families, because we saw at least three males at one time. And all of a sudden, they're gone. They didn't hang around. It was like something frightened them off. It was the end of the season but that was a month ago. So where did they go? We thought they were living here, but apparently not. Thank you.
Wes, where did Don's Baltimore Orioles, goodness, where did they go?
Well, so if they were about a month ago, then my guess is that those were migrating birds. Those were birds that had just started to trickle in from their journeys from farther south up to this area. And so I wouldn't feel, sad that that they were birds trying to nest that failed. My thought is that those were migrating birds that were using that food source, the energy source that he had set out, and getting some more energy from that, and then moving on to find other places to breed into nests. So he did a good thing in helping them go on their way. So it was a great thing.
Wes, we were talking about Goose Pond Fish and Wildlife Area a little bit ago, and I'm sure that that is a place where you have been. And we talked about what you might see there right now. When would you say is an optimal time to go there, and why?
Well, Goose Pond, again, is another place that really changes with the seasons and can be good at any time of year. So as Rob mentioned, now you can see the nesting birds there. Another really cool nesting species they have there is called the black-necked stilt. It's a type of shorebird that looks a bit clown-like. It's very tall, long-legged. It's got these bubblegum pink stilt-like legs. That's where it gets its name. Very striking black and white plumage. And you can see those really right off the highway that sort of bisects the property. But in the fall and spring, it's quite good for waterfowl. So ducks and geese And then as you get into winter, it can be really neat to go as well. You can see, late fall, early spring, you can see pelicans, which a lot of people don't realize. You can see pelicans in Indiana, but big old white pelicans, that's a really good spot to see those. Wow. Sandhill cranes and even our critically endangered whooping cranes can be seen there. So really good spot.
We have a message from David on Facebook who says, I was unable to find a bird in my bird app and my Audubon bird book. Is there a place online where I can go and describe my bird and help find a species? Rob, do we have any resources for David to check out?
Well, the Merlin app could help possibly with some of its questions to narrow down the possibilities. But being in Indiana and having the books and the apps, that everything should be in there. If not, he could even send the question to the local Audubon Society, and someone would be sure to respond and help out with some suggestions.
Is it possible that he was just getting a bad angle on the bird, or maybe it was a juvenile or something like that?
Yeah, especially this time of year, juvenile birds can be really confusing and not necessarily pictured. That's a really, really good observation, Matt, because that can really get people confused. They can look nothing like the adults to start out.
Diane on Facebook sent us a question. She says, what camera gear do you recommend? I love birding, but I'm a frustrated photographer. Wes, we were talking a little bit about gear. Any recommendations for Diane?
Well, again, just like binoculars, there's quite a range, and
you can really get into the weeds pretty quick with photography gear, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, big time. I've got some birder friends who I joke with them that they bring their bazookas when they go birding. You can get these big old 800 millimeter lenses that cost about as much as a new car, Yeah, you can start out with something. They make what are called bridge cameras, which are kind of in between the big fancy cameras, which are called SLRs, and your little point and shoots. And you can get one of those for, again, a couple $100, a few $100, and get a nice little kit. And I think those are really good starter cameras if you're wanting to get into nature photography. So Canon or Nikon or one of those types of things. There's plenty of options out there, certainly.
Rob, let's explore a different kind of habitat. What about the lakeshore? What can we find there up on the shore of Lake Michigan that we won't find necessarily in the woods or on the prairie?
The lakefront is a very exciting area for birding, especially during migration. Not quite as much right on the lakeshore right now, although this year's probably pretty good up there with so few people. But spring and fall migration is quite spectacular on the migrant traps up there along the lakefront. And so all these little woodlots that dot the lakeshore can have hundreds and hundreds of migrant birds stop in after they've migrated overnight so that they can feed and get ready to go on the next day.
And so when you go up there, what can you expect to see and what can you hope to see, I guess, if you were to go up right now?
Right now is a little trickier time up there. Right now I would expect to – I don't go up very often in the summer, to be perfectly honest. I've spent most of my time up there in the spring, fall, and winter.
Hmm. And so if you were to go there during that sort of optimal time – or a more optimal time than, say, right now. Again, same question. What would you expect to see? And then what would be a real treat if you did see something?
At the lakefront, one of the real treats up there for birders is we like to go up in the winter, which sounds pretty terrible to most people to be up on Lake Michigan in the winter. It's windy and cold. But Lake Michigan's really good for different species of gull. So we have lots of gulls that congregate in the winter up there. And so we look for some unusual gulls up there that you wouldn't see anywhere else in the state. They're much more common to get great blackback gull up that way and many others.
Well, Cliff, I mean, it sounds like this is a tough time of year for birding, and really kind of a tough time of year to be outside. I mean, it's hot and it's humid. The canopy's thick. If we go out and hear this cacophony of bird songs and calls, I mean, as hard as it may be to pick out an individual from that, that's a good indicator, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we're still kind of at the tail end of being able to go out in the early morning. to get that cacophony of sound where all the different birds are kind of singing over each other. But we're still at the maybe a couple more weeks for where that's possible. But it does get hot pretty quick, and humidity and everything. But there's some birds that, as a site I like to go to is the Lower Hare Preserve in Blossom Hollow in southern Johnson County. And if you get there pretty early, you usually have the place to yourself. And there's some birds there that do kind of strike out differently that would still be singing. They were singing last week down there. Things like hooded warblers, they just have a bursting song that kind of it's a cool burst of sound that can distinguish itself from everything else around it. And again, sometimes, and again, when folks get more into birding and they're starting to learn all those different songs, sometimes birds don't sing as much after they're done nesting, after their fledglings have left the nest. But they have call notes, and so you can start learning the call notes. And again, like scarlet tanagers, which are real beauties, they're still around. But you might not hear them singing as much in July, but you'll hear they have this chip burr you'll hear through the woods. And if you follow that chip burr sound, you can find a scarlet tanager.
All right, let's see if I can bring this up here. All right, now that's the Scarlet Tanager's song. How about a call? Let's hear that. Aha! I hear what you're talking about. Okay. The chip burr. I know I've heard that before. We have a listener voicemail from Mary Beth in South Bend with a question. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, my name is Mary Beth. I'm a new birder, and early in spring, in the mornings, I would hear this. Something like that. And I was so curious. I had no idea what it was. So would be happy to know. Thanks.
I'm loving everyone's imitations, by the way. Can anyone pick out that that call or that song from Mary Beth? Does anyone recognize something like that, perhaps?
Well, go ahead, Rob.
Oh, It was
Cliff. She said it was early spring, I would think that would have been a overwintering sparrow that was starting to loosen up its pipes before flying north to Canada or maybe northern Michigan. But my guess would be like a white-throated sparrow that because it sounded like the Old Man Peabody, because they kind of sing a song that sounds like Old Man Peabody, Peabody, Peabody.
I want to get into maybe why you like it so much, why it's something you're into. Rob, I'll start with you. Is there a birding moment in either recent history or maybe your past that really sticks with you? Something that you saw in maybe an early migration or something that you had never seen before, something like that?
I think the thing that really sticks with me and makes me love birding, especially in the Midwest, is migration. It's not necessarily one species, but it's the overwhelming number of birds that move through both in the spring and fall, going between their wintering and their breeding grounds. And that time of year is just so exciting to be a birder and to go out every day and have a completely different set of birds that you could see because they've moved on overnight. And so for me, migration is just what always keeps me very excited about birding in the Midwest.
So when is the fall migration? When the range of the spring is like the first 3 weeks of May, correct? And then the fall would be when?
The fall stretches out quite a bit because the birds aren't as in a big hurry. In the spring, they're really rushing to get up to their breeding grounds. In the fall, they're just kind of slowly moving back to their wintering grounds. So we'll see some species of shorebirds moving through even in July, heading back south, the ones that didn't have successful breeding up in the north. And then it'll stretch out through different species and stretch through even into October.
Wes, what about you? What was a birding moment that made your jaw drop?
Oh, so many. One of my favorite, what I call birding spectacles in Indiana, has got to be seeing the fall migration of sandhill cranes. So we have an area in northwestern Indiana called Jasper Pulaski, and you go there in October, November, December, even a little bit, and you can see over 20,000 of these birds congregating in this one little field as they come in from a day foraging before they go go into their evening roost. And that to me, I think, is maybe one of the best birding things you can do in this state.
So to appreciate the significance of that, you have to know a little bit about why it's special that sandhill cranes would choose that spot. What is it about that spot, Wes?
Well, to some extent, there are some things we don't know about why birds like certain places, but there is plenty of fields that have good soil, that have good invertebrate life, and also just spent corn that that the cranes like. So they'll go out and feed in those fields during the day, like I say, and then they do like that there is an adjacent marsh where they can feel safe sleeping at night, safe from predators. So it's sort of the juxtaposition of habitats there that they key in on.
Rob, let's say someone's been listening this hour and they want to get hooked up with the birding community. Where should they go?
I would recommend looking up your local Audubon Society as one of the options. Most of the state should be covered with one Audubon Society. Another great way is online. There are a lot of different birding Facebook groups. If you're on social media, that's a great way to get hooked up with other birders. And then just look at local parks and things like that to see where there might be some hikes. And that's a great way to start meeting other birders in your area as we do start to getting back to doing hikes after COVID now.
Yeah, indeed. Wes, obviously COVID's thrown a wrench into a lot of plans, but are there birding events people might want to consider?
Certainly. And just piggybacking on off of what Rob was saying there, in addition to the local Audubon groups, those Facebook groups there, I'd like to mention too. One is called Birding in Indiana, just Birding in Indiana. And then the other one's called In Nature, capital I, capital N, like the state. So In Nature, those are both two really good Facebook groups that I'd recommend checking out. And then you can also just, you know, for we're kind of Indianapolis centric here, our group, but throughout the state, if you just Google or search Audubon and then plus your city or region, and then the same thing with land trust, just, you know, search land trust and your region or city, and you should be able to find good local groups. But yeah, those would be my couple suggestions.
In our last minute, Wes, where are you going to go next? Any plans?
Well, I'm going to go to work in central Illinois. But as far as for birding tours, we've got a couple things coming up this fall and winter that we'll be looking to do. There's a fall gathering that the Indiana Audubon Society is doing. That'll be September 26th at Fort Harrison State Park. And then this winter, I'd also encourage people to look for their local Christmas bird count. I know we're still a few months away from there, but it'll sneak up on us. But yeah, in December, January, it's a really fun birding thing to do, and it's a good thing for beginner birders as well. So check out Christmas bird counts.
Well, I've had a great time talking about birding today, and I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time. Cliff Chapman is Executive Director of the Central Indiana Land Trust. Welcome back, Cliff, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Matt.
Rob Ripma is president of the Amos Butler Audubon Society. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Matt. Happy to be here.
Wes Homoya is founder of Feathers and Fermentation Tours. Thanks to you, Wes.
Thank you so much.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme music. Our podcast can be found anywhere you find podcasts. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.